Hey everybody, I'm Eric with a K. Very happy to be with you guys tonight, and thrilled actually to be able to introduce our speaker tonight. Kathy H. from Cincinnati was, first time I met her was in Las Vegas. I was at a convention there. I was asked to host her as the guest speaker for a big AA convention that happens every December there. And I didn't know her much before then. And I remember calling Jack and saying, Jack, how do you host? What is that? He told me that basically I just need to be a her man Friday for the whole weekend. Just make sure that pay for anything, get her food and get her around and maybe take her to see something nice around Vegas. And so I remember being there at the conference, and we were talking, I remember over a meal once, and she mentioned to me, she goes, you know, every time someone speaks for Al-Anon, there's always that the talk they wanted to give, then there's the talk they actually give, and then there's the talk they wish they gave. And I got to spend so much time with Kathy in those few days we were there that I got to kind of hear the story she wanted to tell, the one she actually told, and the one she wished she told. And I got to know her really well, and she's just fabulous, just amazing person. And Al-Anon, I think she's probably my favorite, not probably, she is my favorite female Al-Anon speaker of all time. So I couldn't be more excited to have her here tonight. Jack would be the one normally introducing her. It was Jack that asked her to come and speak. Jack can't because he's working right now, but so I'm just happy he's working, that I get a chance to say hi again to Kathy, tell her how much I love her and appreciate her, and look forward to hearing you tonight. So that's enough for me talking. I'll turn the time over now to Kathy, who will speak for us tonight. Thank you.
All right. Lower your expectations. Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy, and I am recovering one day at a time in the Worldwide Al-Anon Family Group. And I really so appreciate Jack's invitation to share at your meeting. And Eric, thank you so much for that introduction. And thanks again for Las Vegas. I remember that we took a break from the convention and went to see the Hoover Dam. I mean, that will always, you know, that was great. Welcome to all of those of you who are new. I hope you might hear something tonight that you can connect with. I was just sharing in my home group, we were talking about the fifth step, and I was saying, you know, one of the most important pieces for me about that fifth step is that piece of, you know, the exact nature of our wrongs. I had gone to so many places and talked to so many people before I found Al-Anon, but never did I ever have a sense that they really understood what I was living with or how I was feeling. I mean, I have dear friends even today who used to say to me, well, maybe you should just sit down and talk to them. You know, there's no talking somebody out of alcoholism. But, you know, it wasn't until I found you that I really felt like I was exactly where I was supposed to be. That was my experience. I hope for some of you that will be your experience as well. And congratulations to those of you that have birthdays. Way to be, you know. I'm glad Jack told me my time, because I could sometimes you just get so excited they go on and on and on, and it's really no fun for anybody but me. So let me just be as brief as I can and keep it under control. So I am, you know, like to say that I'm a middle kid who grew up in middle America, middle class. Pretty, you know, not terribly different from anybody else in the neighborhood. We were all pretty much the same. The only difference was I was a number. I have five brothers and sisters, and we were raised by really funny parents. I mean, my mom and dad, they could have been a comedy team. They were just funny people. And anything that came up, they just, you know, they turned it into a joke. I mean, it would just be this big story that they would tell with relish. And I don't know, that's how most of us learn and still do deal with things that come up. That can, you know, it sounds great, but that can be dangerous when you apply that to alcoholism, because I found myself minimizing things. I found myself taking situations which were not funny, that were painful, and making sound like they were these funny stories. And they weren't. And what happened then for me is it kept me in a state of denial about the situation I was living in, but also about how I was feeling. So I grew up in this family where humor is important, but what also is important is faith. I was delivered an education, really all through grade school, high school, college, delivered to me by nuns. My high school and college were all women, you know, all girls high school, all women's college. And, you know, these women really, they were three different orders, but they all seemed to emphasize the same thing. The importance of love, the importance of service, the importance of offering things up. There aren't bad things. I mean, those aren't bad ideals. I remember somebody telling me once when Dr. Bob was interviewed and was asked if he could sift down the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous into just a few brief words, what would they be? And he said, love and service. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, it sounds like one of my nuns. But it's difficult. Well, let me just say this. I think you're mostly men. But for women, my experience has been self-care often sounds a lot like selfishness and self-centeredness. Most of us coming out of my generation, at any rate, were never really taught how to care for ourselves. We were taught how to take care of others. We were taught, you know, how to read the room. So, you know, as a kid, you know, it was always important for me to know how you were feeling. If you were feeling badly, or if you were feeling bad, I would cheer you up. If you were feeling sad, I'd try to make you laugh. It was always other directed, not so much paying attention to me. I say to people, I hear an Al-Anon a lot, I was addicted to the alcoholic. I never felt like I was addicted to the alcoholic. What I was addicted to was approval. Being right, how things looked, making sure that, you know, everybody was at ease, we're all in harmony. And so it, to me, was no surprise that I would be attracted to somebody that could care less what you thought of him, who ate meat on Friday, didn't care. And that's exactly what happened to me. When I met my husband, I was between my junior and senior year in college. And at the time, I was dating this really kind, young man, patient, thoughtful. He'd send me flowers, you know, to the dorm in the middle of the week for no reason. Have a great Wednesday. So there was that. I mean, you know, loyal, true. Now I start dating this guy who was a Marine. I knew his sister vaguely, and she called me during the summer and said, hey, look, my brother's down in Meridian, Mississippi, in flight training. He's coming to Cincinnati for Labor Day weekend. I've run out of people to fix him up with. Would you go out with him? That's just the kind of invitation I love. Of course I will. I'll do that. Yes. Vietnam War's raging, my patriotic duty. I'll go out with this Marine. So I do. And right off the bat, I'm overwhelmed by this guy. I don't know anybody like this guy. He doesn't walk down the street. He swaggers down the street. He knows everything. He's sure of himself. He, you know, he knows what he likes, knows what he wants, doesn't mince his words. I'm captivated by that kind of personality. I mean, I think to myself, this is great. What I also noticed, however, was that you just never knew what he was going to do next. And I thought when I was 20 that was pretty exciting. So from an early age, you know, I've got all these red flags that I'm painting green. I'm dismissing that. I'm minimizing that. Oh, yeah, he's got a horrible temper. But you know what? I can fix that. I mean, me? People love me. I'm funny. I'm easygoing. Oh, he'll just be fine with me. So, you know, 21 years old, I got this choice. A guy that sends me flowers for no reason. Or the guy who takes me to Coney Island and tries to rock us out of the top of the Ferris wheel. What can I say? I picked the Ferris wheel guy. So, you know, it was just really that, it sounds simple, but what happened was he was, after I graduated from college, I went to Chicago to teach school. And I came home to Cincinnati for Christmas, and he came up from, at the time, he was in Havelock, North Carolina at the time. He came in for Christmas too, and we were having dinner at his home. He was one of seven, and he said, I've got an announcement to make. This is what he says to his family at this dinner. And we're all waiting to hear what this announcement could be, including me. And he says, Kathy and I are going to get married. Well, I didn't know that, but this is how I operate. I'm thinking to myself, what do I say here? That's crazy. You've got to go to Vietnam. I'm under contract with this little Catholic school in Chicago. That nun will kill me if I break the contract. I only have the wherewithal at that time in my life, 21, 22 years of age. I'm one that just doesn't want to make waves. So what I do instead is think to myself, well, we probably were going to get married. I mean, at some point, I didn't know we were going to do it anytime soon, but I go along with it. We go back to my parents, make this announcement. My parents, looking back on it, almost fell off the couch. But God love them. They never, you know, they never said a word like, this is a mistake. This doesn't seem to be something like you had on your radar. We believe you're being whatever. They just were quiet about it. And so I broke my contract with a little nun up in Chicago. We were married in January. I got pregnant in February, and he got his orders to go to Vietnam in March. One of the things that I noticed early in those early months of my marriage was this: anger seeks a target. And it became very important to me not to be the target. I used to compliment myself on how well I could manage and avoid his anger. Like that was a trait that, you know, you wanted to develop. But the truth is, I knew 10 days into my marriage that I was in over my head. I couldn't tell you any one thing, but I just sensed something was going on here. The drinking, what can I say? I don't know if any of you are Marines, but the drinking was always there, you know? But I noticed he drank differently than even the Marines. When his drinking, let me just say, well, his drinking was different. his drinking was different. And what I would do when he drank was I began to count. I just began to focus on him, to notice how much he was drinking so that I could gauge how I could be. So early on, it was how is he so I know how I can be. But my point, I guess, in telling you that is this. 10 days in, I knew I was out of my league. And instead of saying, hey, I don't know what's going on here, but this isn't working for me. I'm out of here. Nope. What I did instead was to pretend, to take that fear, take that anger, to take that growing deep concern, and just pretended like, you know, things, just pretended like things were fine. So from that point on, I became responsible. I mean, when I hear people say, oh, I was so, you know, we say an Al-Anon, which is sometimes true, but not always. you know, we try to avoid that victimhood. You know, I mean, I was not a victim. I was a willing participant in this situation because it was too hard for me to admit that I perhaps couldn't handle this, that I couldn't just, you know, walk away and say, good luck, but I can't do this. This is beyond my pay grade. So I stood in there, you know, I stayed in there just trying everything that I could, trying to make it work, trying to adjust my behavior in such a way that maybe I could change him. But I have to say, when he got his orders to go to Vietnam and he left for Vietnam, I was so terribly relieved. And I had only been married for 6 months. I mean, so when I got back to Cincinnati, and I'm only going to tell this story very quickly. When I got back to Cincinnati, I went home to stay with my parents, and I immediately made the phone call to the priest that had married us. And as I was walking out the front door of my home, my mother said to me, I hope you're not going to tell him anything personal, because, you know, that's how many of us were raised. You just didn't share that sort of thing with anybody. You just kept it to yourself. I was just saying to somebody else just this past week, isn't it funny that when we were kids and when we got married, it's like our parents kind of patted us on the back and said, good luck. Hope things work out for you. Send me a card at Christmas. I mean, there wasn't all this involvement that I feel that I'm so involved with my adult children. I never had any of that. My parents loved me, but it was like, good luck. Hope things work out. See you later. So the long and short of all that is, while he was overseas, he has a number of sisters, and we at that time and still are very, very close. And we used to talk all the time about him, and I wonder what makes him so angry, and I wonder this, and I wonder, always the focus on somebody else. Always talking about someone else, always thinking, you know, I mean, later on that he was qualifying me for this program, where indeed I'm qualifying me for this program. And so he came back from Vietnam, decided to use the GI Bill to go to dental school, got into a bad bar fight before he left for Ohio State, and the drinking stopped. For those 3 years when he was in dental school at Ohio State, no drinking. I thought it was because I had listened to those nuns and I had been long-suffering, I had been patient, I hadn't complained, I hadn't nagged, and now it's all working, you know, it's all coming to fruition. Gets the dental degree, move back to Cincinnati, and everything falls apart because he now has the ability to write himself a prescription for narcotics, which didn't last very long. Prescription narcotic, that didn't last very long before the Renew agents, the Regional Enforcement Narcotics Unit, caught on to him, and he was thrown out of dentistry. And then he went back to what he knew, which was just really the drinking. But this is what's, you know, what happened to me is this, because, you know, Al-Anon is about us. We say it all the time. We keep the focus on us. What I was doing was trying to keep from you any hint that my life wasn't exactly the way that I wanted it. I, you know, everything was great. He got out of dentistry because it was too boring for him. And now he's taken up a new profession. You know, he's decided to be a fur trader. Now, that's a very difficult profession to try to push, I would say to people. It's very lucrative. And it was in the 1780s, not so much in the 1980s. But I made it sound like, oh, this is great. He's trapping fox. He's selling the furs downtown. He's got a great vegetable garden going. He's raising bees. He's got making honey, blah, 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 blah. Am I doing that to protect him? Not for a minute. I'm doing that so I don't look bad. I'm doing that because what would you think of me if you knew what I was living with? And so what is becoming important is how things look for me. So I'm painting him as this, you know, Renaissance man because I can't live any other way. I can't let you know that I'm totally out of ideas, that all the humor in the world is not fixing this, that all my stories that I, you know, I would say to people, he supplies me with great material, and he did. But that's no way to conduct, you know, an intimate relationship. It's no way to conduct a relationship when you're waiting to see how someone is going to be so you can know, you know, so you can know how to be. It's no way for me to be constantly gathering evidence against him, because I'm afraid one day I will have to leave, and I want to make sure that you know who was the bad guy and who was the saint. I mean, all of that stuff is me. It's me. You know, I didn't nag him. I didn't name call. I didn't do any of that. I just ignored him. I just would erase him as a human being. And I was never raised to treat anyone sick that way. But I have no answers, you know? So very quickly, what happened is one of my sister-in-laws, I need to tell you, at the time when he graduated from dental school, his family, his parents, his father raised quarter horses. So they had a lot of land outside of the city. It was a beautiful spread of land. It's developed now, but it was just gorgeous. It's a horse farm overlooking the Ohio River, big main house, stables. If you'd come to see me, I mean, we lived in this little house next to the main house. It was called the summer house because that's where they used to put up fruits and vegetables back in the 30s or 40s or something. So, but on this land are some of his sisters. And what happened was one sister decided that she was going to join Al-Anon. And so she went to a few meetings, and the women there suggested she try the meeting across the hall, which she did. And so very shortly, I've got one sister, two sisters, three sisters, four sister-in-laws in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very quickly. It was like the domino theory. Boom, boom, boom. And, they're coming around, and they're coming around with their big books, and they're coming around talking about recovery. They're coming around talking about alcoholism being a family disease. And I want none of it. I'm very happy for them. Glad their lives are changing. Glad they're finding some peace. But I'm done. I'm not going to go to those meetings. I mean, please keep coming back. I mean, what? What is it, a cult? I'm already in a cult, the Catholic Church. Anyway, so I don't want to do it. I'm done. I've been to the priests. I've been to social workers. I've been to a psychic. I've been all over the joint. Nothing's helping. Forget it. But what scared me was this, that idea that it's a family disease. That totally freaked me out. Because at the time, I'm pregnant with child number 7. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, if this is a family disease, I'm never going to get away from this. This is going to just follow me through my whole life. I better investigate. And that's what I tell people who, you know, talk to me about Al-Anon. Why don't you just go to 4 to 6 meetings, investigate, just see. Just hang around, see if there's anything that, you know, connects. Just investigate. And that's what I did. And what I found in Al-Anon, quite frankly, is what I still find today. It's not a passive program. It's not a passive program. It is a program of action. We talk about the three A's. Awareness, acceptance, action. What is critical for somebody like me is that I can let go of the results, that I can take action and let go of the results. I'll tell you something that's come up for me in this past, well, not just this past week, but specifically in this past week. I don't know how it is in California, but in Ohio, the politics are enough to make anybody crazy. So this is my plan of action, and it's right out of Al-Anon. I become aware. I accept the situation for what's going on. I take all those actions that I believe are mine to take as a responsible citizen. And then I'll vote. But I cannot become attached to the results. I cannot. It will ruin my emotional, spiritual, and probably my physical health. And so that's the same thing with alcoholism. I become aware, I accept, and I take the appropriate action. But I have to let go of the results. I have to. I've got kids in recovery, and I have kids who are not in recovery. I have phone numbers that I keep for those kids who are still out there and who I think may one day benefit from Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't push them. I don't, if they ask me, I'll say, hey, I've got some phone numbers for you, and here they are. I did that with one of my kids not so long ago. what I do is I call Bob D and I say, who do you have in this state? Who do you have in this city? And he always gives me a list of names and numbers. I pass them on. So not so long ago, he gave me a list of names for this one kid who's out of state. And I, when this child asked me, I said, this is what I got. And not so long ago, he called again and said, you know, I lost his numbers. Do you still have them? I wanted to say, do I still have them? They're tattooed on my chest, you idiot. Of course I still have them. But so, you know, it's not a passive program. I think that's one of the first things. Even though we admit that we are powerless over alcohol, where we can see that our lives have become unmanageable, it doesn't mean that we're helpless. That's what I hear all the time when I came in, and still today. There is a difference between being powerless and being helpless. It is true, however, that I am responsible for my own recovery. I certainly am. But for me, in my experience, recovery happens outside of the meetings. I go to meetings because it is in meetings that I know and understand that there is a solution. There is a solution. But it's outside of the meeting when I begin to practice these principles, when I actually begin to change my attitudes and my behavior, that I begin that slow, steady process of recovering. I have said before, Al-Anon is not my whole life, but Al-Anon allows me to lead a life that is whole, and that's huge. That's huge. So the other thing that we hear a lot of in Al-Anon is, you know, detach. And we come to see that detaching is neither kind nor unkind. It just means that I cannot get into your consequences. For the women that I sponsor, oftentimes I would like to remind them, alcoholism is like quicksand. I get in there thinking, oh, I can fix this. Oh, I can help here. Oh, I know what to do. And the next thing I know, I'm up to my neck fighting for my breath. It's like quicksand. I have a deep respect for this disease. So, you know, it's for me, you know, it's the humility. It's the humility that becomes so, so very important. We had, when we were still meeting, which we're not anymore, of course, in person, there are a few meetings that meet in parking lots, but my home group were still on Zoom. And some other meetings that I go to are Zoom meetings, but when we were meeting in person, I was doing a beginners group, which runs concurrently to our main meeting. And a woman said to me, well, it sounds to me like you can't keep my son alive, but if the worst happens, you know, this is going to be this place will make me feel a little better. And I said to her, well, I wanted to say to her, yeah, that is true. We cannot keep your kids alive. We can't. And it's not that we'll make you feel better, but we will offer you what has been offered to us, which is spiritual. It's a spiritual path. It's a spiritual way of life, which requires, I believe, from all of us, a constant letting go. Letting go of the way we think things should be, letting go of the way, you know, we think our lives are going to unfold. It's just always asking me to put on a cloak of humility and one more time, let go. I have a friend who's a 911. She's retired now, 911 operator. And she told me once that when one of her more important training sessions, they were telling these 911 operators that if someone calls and they are in the midst themselves of a horrific accident and are just hanging on, waiting, it's so important for the 911 operator to say, hang in there. Help is on the way. You're going to be okay. You're going to be all right. Someone's coming. Just hang in there. It's going to be okay. You're going to make it. When they get that kind of message, their chances of surviving increase. Oftentimes, I think that's what we do in Al-Anon. We just, you know, hang in there. I know it's rough. It's going to be okay. When my kids, and I've had kids at different times who have been in juvenile detention. When I had children in juvenile detention, not all at the same time, they took their turns. And people would say to me, oh, ha, ha, they're just out there writing their leads. Oh, ha, ha. That's not helpful to me, not as a mother. What's helpful to me is when you come up to me after a meeting and you say, you know, Kathy, I have a son in jail today and I know it's hard. Yeah, I mean, I know it's difficult visiting day. Yeah, they go through your blah, 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 blah. I know how hard that is. But aren't we lucky that we don't have to walk through that journey alone? That's what's helpful for me. That's what's helpful for me. Not minimizing. There's no inoculation for the pain of seeing a child appear before you in a court of law in handcuffs and shackles. It isn't. Recovery is a double-edged sword. It allows me to feel my feelings again. But the good news is none of us have to do that alone. None of us have to do that alone. And for that, you know, I'm so very grateful. So all those things that I learned and continue to learn in Al-Anon are helpful. You know, that saying, you could be right. I say it all the time. I always thought that I was the keeper of truth and justice in the relationship. Al-Anon teaches me differently. Al-Anon leads me to an attitude and to words that say, you know, you could be right. You could be right. Thomas Merton says in one of our daily readings, there's a quote from him. Actually, it's in our One Day at a Time book. It's used again. It was just used again, but he's not given whatever you call it. Whatever, you know what I mean. They don't say it's from Thomas Merton, but it is. The beginning of love is to allow those we love to be themselves perfectly. That doesn't mean I have to put up with unacceptable behavior. But the lesson there for me is this. People are who they are. They are who they are, and they do not need me to get in there and manage and manipulate and try to fix and try to make their rough road smooth. I have no idea the lessons that my kids, for example, need to learn in this life. That's the kind of stuff I learn in Al-Anon, but I only learn it when I'm willing to admit that I am powerless, when I only come to realize that there is a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. You know, when I really believe that failure is the beginning of wisdom, that's what I learn and continue to learn all the time in Al-Anon. But I have to say also, even though we have a great time in my meetings, there is this thread of grief that connects us all, because there is nothing easy watching those we love go down that slippery slope of alcoholism. So there is also that, but it's very unusual, isn't it, to be in a fellowship where you hold in one hand such great hope. We hold that for one another, and at the same time, we are present to the grief that many in the meeting experience. I go to meetings with men and women who have buried their children as a result of this disease. I go to meetings with men and women whose kids are in recovery. I go to meetings with men and women who have no idea where their children might be today. And yet they show up. They show up and they're willing to share their experience, their strength, and their hope. They show up and lead lives of grace and hope and service. And they're the ones I want to go to meetings with, and they're the ones I want to be with, and they're the ones I want to share a birthday with. So, you know, for those of you who are new, this really is an almost overwhelming fellowship of men and women who live lives of great generosity of spirit. And the gratitude I feel for each and every one of you, even though I know hardly any of you, is really very moving. It's deeply moving, and you give me great hope. So, you know, I have a sponsor who always says to me, particularly when it comes to the third step, she'll say, "Let God sort it out, Kathy. Let God sort it out. Make a decision. Let God sort it out. Don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. Don't let the perfect get in the way of the good." And so, you know, each day, it sounds very corny, and I don't even really say this much here in Cincinnati, but I don't know any of you, so I can say it. You know, in the morning, in my morning prayer and meditation, I really do ask the God of my understanding for that day, just for today, show me the work that you would have me participate in the building of a just and compassionate world. Show me today the work you would have for me. Now, my ego wants it to be some huge thing. You know, that's what my ego wants. But you know what it almost always turns out to be? Somebody calls me on the phone. It's usually somebody just calls on the phone and said, "Hey, can you listen for this? Can you just listen to me for a few minutes?" And then I have the willingness, because of you, to say, "Okay." So, you know, I think that in Al-Anon, particularly for those of us that are old, and particularly in this time of COVID, where so many of us are, you know, quarantined or we're inside, we really rely a lot on one another for compassionate listening. And I don't think that you can put a price on that. Because for so many women that I sponsor, I mean, we don't give advice, or we shouldn't be giving advice. It's just a lot of compassionate listening. It's a lot of, I mean, it's just, you know, in playing back to them what they're saying, making some suggestions, but mainly just sharing my own experience when I've run into the exact same thing then and today. you know, I, you know, we talk in Al-Anon, I thought I had all this time. We talk in Al-Anon about the four M's, and I never really paid much attention to them until recently. I mean, not until recently, until, you know, some of our literature started being produced. But for those of us in Al-Anon, those four M's, the managing, the manipulation, the martyrdom, and the mothering, I could do my own, my fourth step just on those four M's. I had to look when I knew that a fourth step was absolutely critical. Doing a fourth step and getting a sponsor were absolutely critical for me to get anywhere into this program. My sponsor likes to say the first three steps just calm you down. But that fourth step, I had to take a look at what I call my arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. My, you know, criticism, judgment, you know, this cold silence, all those things, how I constantly use them to manage, to manipulate, to make sure that you knew how, you know, the suffering I was going through. All those things came up. It has to be fearless and searching for somebody like me. For somebody like me that's addicted to approval. For somebody like me that wants to be right. For somebody like me pays attention to how things look. Searching and fearless were the only two adjectives that would work in a moral inventory. But as I already shared, you know, to be able to go with that, to the God of my understanding, to admit it to myself and go to a trusted friend in the program who understands, as few, too few do, the exact nature. I have a woman friend that does not talk about defects of character. She talks about defenses that we have built up that, of course, become our defects. It's a little different spin, but it's been helpful to me to look at those things that I do to defend my small self in this program. So I had, I had just gotten really done a fourth step, hadn't really gotten into much into a ninth step with my husband before he was killed suddenly in a helicopter crash, but what was really important for me in my program was that my attitude towards him had changed as a result of recovering with you. So I used to say to people, you know, he doesn't have a job. Now he's working construction. He's gone on the weekends, flying up in this homemade helicopter. And you would say to me, well, does he find any peace in that? And I would say, it's probably the only peace he knows. And then you said, well, why would you want to take that away from him? And so my whole attitude towards it changed. And so very slowly but surely my attitude towards him changed. And I began to see where I was at fault. I began to see how I was keeping this thing going. All those, I don't think I could have ever reached that without this program. Honestly. So, but his death left me with these seven kids under the age of 14, and I'm not much of a disciplinarian, so things got out of hand quickly, and I took them all to this grief counselor who, I mean, 15 minutes into the first session, threw them out. I mean, he just said, go into the waiting room, just get. And they did. And I said to him, I don't know if I'm going to be able to raise these kids by myself. And he said, you can't. You're understaffed. You're understaffed. What a wonderful thing to say to me. Because it was another way of saying to me, you know, you're going to be powerless over a lot of this stuff. You're not helpless, but you're going to be powerless. You're understaffed. And I knew then that I was going to have to partner with a power greater than myself in order to see these kids hopefully stay alive. And, you know, honestly, that's just That's just how it worked. I couldn't have done it, I don't think, sanely without Al-Anon, because one day at a time, you were there with me step by step. You were sharing with me things that worked in your program. You were telling me I didn't have to, you know, when they had to go to court, as eventually all of them did for one thing or another, that it was important that, you know, the consequences were their consequences, not mine. You began to show me how important it was to cooperate with their teachers, with their coaches, with their guidance counselors, with the courts, with the Cincinnati Police Department, all of those things, one day at a time. And that's, you know, that's really how it worked. And when some of these kids started getting in trouble, you showed me, you know, you showed me ways of being a parent where I could be loving, but without being enabling. That I could be, you know, I could be strict, but I didn't have to be totally unbending. And so, you know, in a very general way, I can tell you that, you know, that's pretty much how it worked for me. I have one daughter who called me, oh my goodness, I'm going to say back in 2000, I know it was back in 2002, and she's out of town. And she said to me, "Mom, I think my drinking is getting out of control, and I think I need to do something about it." And I said, "What led you to that discovery?" And she said, "Because my husband said to me last night, when you drink, I feel like I'm walking on eggshells." And she said, I know what that means. I know, I've heard that before. I know what that means. What should I do?" And I said, "Well, you know, you can call Chicago AA, or you can, you know, I can get a number for you." And she said, "Well, why don't you get a number for me?" So, of course, I called this guy, Bob, and he's got this guy and four numbers that go with this guy. And I call her back and give her the four numbers. And boom, the next day, this guy's got her, and she's been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 18 years this month, actually, the month of September. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's the fingerprints of God all over my life. Just all over my life, I see those fingerprints of God. But it would never have happened for me unless I had that willingness. And sometimes I had to borrow your willingness to become entirely ready, to humbly ask God to do for me what I could not do for myself, to make the list, to listen to you when you told me that the most powerful amends I can make to my children is to give them a healthy parent. That was so important for me to hear. I am still, last week on Wednesday, after I babysat for one of the boys who lives, for one of his children, I got in my car and I drove 8 hours to Pennsylvania to another son who's moving. And I worked Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and drove back on Sunday. Somebody said to me, "Why would you do that? You're old." And I said, "Because I offered to help." And they said, "Great, we need help." And it's my way of continuing to make amends to these kids. I do it joyfully. I love it. Because the truth is, they didn't get everything that they needed. They had a single mother who had to go back to work, go to school at night, go to school in the summers, get to meetings, on and on and on and on. So any opportunity I have to mother those kids in a positive way, I'll do it. And I do it joyfully, because that's how you taught me to be of service, to tell you the truth. So I just want to wrap it up kind of by saying, today, doing those daily inventories is important. When I'm wrong, admitting that I'm wrong, I don't like to carry baggage. So I do it really because it's so much easier for me when I'm wrong to do it and get it done. But in prayer and meditation, I think particularly in these times, for me, is critical. And I'm blessed that I'm retired from teaching, because I can spend a lot of time in prayer and meditation. I have this little ritual that I do that seems to work. I'm a swimmer. So I used to be able to do a lot of quiet time in the water. Things have closed up a lot around here, but it's still possible for me because it's summer. There's a pool right at the end of my street. Have to make a reservation. But nonetheless, I get up there and I swim. And when I swim, I count. But this is how I count. I go up. Step one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, come back. Step two, came to believe all the way back. Step three, made it. So I just swim the steps. I just swim the steps back and forth. That's not my prayer and meditation. That's just a practice that I have found that is very important for me. It keeps me focused. It keeps me grounded. Because there is, I don't know how it is in California, but there is a lot of anxiety going on. I hear it in the women that I sponsor. I see it around me. And so the importance of prayer and meditation for me is critical. And no matter what, you know, all of us get an invitation to step into an intimate relationship with the God of our understanding. I believe I got my invitation through the family disease of alcoholism. That's what I firmly believe. So, what else can I tell you? I just believe that the whole thing works because we are willing to take the experience of our lives and spin it into gold for others. But that only works if I'm willing to, you know, pick up the phone or, mainly pick up the phone anymore, or when I'm asked to share my own story, to be willing to share it, because that's how it works. That's, you know, the service that I know. I will tell you that one tricky thing I think about Al-Anon, somebody called me not so long ago and asked me to do something, and I said, I said, no, you know, I just don't think that's going to work for me. And she said, oh, you're not allowed to say no to an Al-Anon request. And I said, really? I don't know where you read that, because in Al-Anon, I'm pretty sure what a lot of us are trying to do is say no. I mean, my recovery has gotten me to a point where I can sift through. I mean, that's what got me in trouble to begin with. Oh, yeah, sure, I'm pick me, I'll do it. Oh, yeah, I'll do it. No, I don't care. Yeah, no. That's not a spiritual path for me. For me, discernment, making those decisions about what really I believe I'm being called to do, not what you're calling me to do, but what the God of my understanding and I are able to work out, that's what's important for me in my recovery. You know, that nice guy back when I was in college, who used to send me flowers, he contacted me in 1998, and he's a bachelor, never had gotten married. And he said to me, he used to live out in California, actually, in Encino for about 12 and a half years, but then he moved back to his hometown of Indianapolis. And so he contacted me in 98, and he said, hey, you know, we always got along so well. I mean, we were dear friends, really, more than anything else in college. He said, I don't know where you are in your life right now, but, you know, I moved back to Indianapolis and kind of close. How would you feel about meeting for dinner occasionally? So I'm thinking, what? I mean, I'm the poster child for single women. I love being single. I love coming home from teaching high school and painting my living room red. And then 2 weeks later, coming home from high school and think, I'm going with salmon. I love it. Popcorn for dinner. I mean, you can't beat it. It's a great way to live. Women would say to me, but don't you want someone to send you flowers? I'd say, why? You can go to Kroger and get any flowers you want for like $4.50. Come on. This is great. So now he's calling and I'm like, what? What does this mean, God? Help me out here. So I thought, well, what can hurt? Dinner. I mean, dinner can't hurt, right? So that's what happened. So 98. So we just dated like for the next 7 years until my youngest child graduated from college. And then it just made such perfect sense to me. He'd been sober since 1990. Why would I not want to spend my life with a kind, loving, patient, compassionate guy? I don't know. I mean, I still don't know. It's been, I hate to say it's been great, but you know what? It has been great. Have we had problems? No, we haven't. Who knew? No kids, no ex-wife. That's what I call a double winner. I mean, it's really, it's like living with a monk. He's so nice. And what's really great, he thinks everything I do is funny. And it's really not. But he thinks it is. He's sound asleep right now. So anyway, it's just sometimes I'm eating dinner with and and we will say over and over again, who would have thought in 1965 that we would be here together? My brother at our wedding said, you know, these two started dating the year Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare into law. And they finally sealed the deal when they were eligible for it. I mean, and it's just the way that it is. So the last thing I'm going to say at 11:18 p.m. my time is this. One of the greatest gifts my late husband gave his children is the service in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, because unbeknownst to me until I started teaching high school, which is a story in and of itself, all our kids were eligible for free college tuition. It's the War Orphan Scholarship. Every state has it. So all my kids could go to college for free. And thank God, Ohio's got great state schools. And except for one who's in the military, still in the military today, he and his wife are pilot instructors. Actually, he's flying a Chinook into Lunkin Airport 10 minutes from me, if that, next Wednesday. But other than him, they all took advantage of it, except one daughter who won a scholarship to St. Louis University. So she graduates in the late 90s, St. Louis University. All the kids and I drive over to St. Louis, you know, for the big graduation. And they had the service in the little chapel at St. Louis, and we're all sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting for the lady who's the head of the college to come. She gets there late, and she's very apologetic. Stands in front of us and says, I'm so sorry I'm late. I know many of you came from far and wide, but I have to tell you, my little 7-year-old just learned the Lord's Prayer, and I had to listen to him recite it before I left home. And this is what he said. Our Father, who art in heaven, how'd you know my name? And all those years ago, I heard her say that. And do you know, still to this day, I will tell you that the greatest gift I have received from this program, this fellowship, has been to get back in touch into an intimate relationship with a God who knows my name. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you so much for allowing me to share with you my story, a part of my story.